Good morning. You're listening to Expansion on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. I'm Sophia, your host, and today I'm very, very proud to have a guest on who is perhaps the grandmaster of researchers in this particular area, the area of aerosol spraying, popularly known as chemtrails, a word that is avoided by some for particular reasons, which we may get into. I myself have put up a website. It's a subsite or subsection of my main site, 911weknow.com, and it operates on its own URLs, aboutthesky.com and contrailsmyass.com. This is a humorous web address so that people will catch on, you know, from another angle. Sometimes humor is the best way to help people understand something. I have delved into the study of aerosol operations over the past couple of years, noticing them myself. Wherever I happen to go, it occurs in states on the East Coast, in the South, West Coast. I hear that it goes on even in Canada, all over the world. China, they started spraying. Someone sent me a picture from July 4th, the first chemtrail that he saw in China, and he has been living there. And I would like to not waste any more time and bring on our guest, Clifford Carnicom. Clifford, are you with us?
I am. Good morning, Sophia. Thanks very much for the chance to be here today.
Well, we worked to plan this show for a while, and I'm very glad we finally have our date and our time, and hopefully we'll get into some very important basic questions that need to be clarified. I believe, Clifford, you come from a research background with the Department of Defense, Bureau of Land Management, and the Forest Service.
That's correct. I was a federal employee for 15 years. I spent about 10 years in the educational system and worked for the federal government for 15 years in three different agencies, BLM, Forest Service, and the Department of Defense. A peak of my career work with the feds was as a geodesist. And a geodesist is someone who works with quite a few disciplines, mathematics, geophysics, physics, this type of thing. And I was a research scientist with them, primarily doing what's called gravity modeling the gravity field of the Earth. My background is you know, reasonably strong, I would say, in the technical sciences and a bit in the life sciences and this type of thing. I think that's fair to say.
Well, your website is quite extensive and very scientific in its articles and postings and the research that you have done, which I think is extremely important to this field. We are departing for our break, and we'll pick up on the other side.
Sure, thanks a lot.
You're listening to Expansion on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm speaking today with researcher Clifford Carnicom, who is perhaps the most accomplished scientist who has been looking at the aerosol operations. His website is carnicom.com, carnicom.com. And Clifford, I wanted to make something very plain and clear to everyone listening today. This definition of a contrail, I use the Gertrude Stein type line, a contrail is a contrail is a contrail, meaning that contrails are a certain kind of phenomenon, and the term that is bandied about by authorities, this persistent jet contrail, to describe what we're seeing in the sky, can you clarify very simply what it takes for a contrail, a true contrail, to form?
I'm sure I'll do my best, and I don't claim to have all knowledge and expertise. I do the best I can. I'm a citizen and independent researcher and observer, and I do my homework the best I can, and I'll try to help out today the best I can. A contrail, really, if you trace back the origin of the word, it came from two words joined together. It was the word condensed, and it was the word trail. Condensed refers to water. This is where it came from, condensation of water. So, you know, with the advent of high-altitude aviation, close of World War II or so, you had a phenomenon that appeared that, you know, basically had not been achieved before with mankind. You had something. You needed to create a term to describe it. The elements and components of that phenomenon were identified. They were two things at the time, and that was, number one, the condensation of water, and the second being a trail or a visible line of that water vapor. Now, that's what the origin is. That's where it comes from. Now, in terms of what does it take to create such a thing, I actually don't think it's that complicated to speak of the formation of a contrail. You're talking about something being emitted from an engine. Again, by definition, water vapor. That engine will be producing it in a heated form, a vapor form. What is it subjected to? It's subjected to an environment that is, by any measure, no way around it, it's extremely cold at the altitude we're speaking of. I'm talking roughly 40,000 feet, maybe 30 to 45,000 feet range. Let's call 40,000 feet, or let's call whatever, 35 to 40,000 feet as our environment. The temperature up there is plain cold. I've looked at the upper altitude data quite a bit, and you're commonly talking 40 degrees below zero, 40, 50 degrees below zero is common temperature. It's also a reasonably stable environment. It's not like the ground in the sense of the variation of moisture content and this type of thing. The moisture content at upper altitude in the air is actually relatively low. As a matter of fact, an interesting side point was I did some reading on the to try to determine what we're talking about. What is the humidity up there and how does it vary? And when the supersonic transport was active in raising a lot of environmental concern, one of the things that they were looking at was what was the humidity level up there where it was expected to fly, which would be higher, more like probably 50 to 55,000, I would guess. And the humidity level up there was 5%. So the general pattern is the higher you go, the colder it gets and also the less humid it gets. So, you know, what would happen by common sense if we were to take a water vapor, heated water vapor, and subject it to an environment where it's 40 degrees below zero? And what would happen is it would freeze. It would freeze instantly. And this is what happens. What happens to you and me when we're up in Minnesota or Michigan and it's 40 degrees below zero and we breathe and expel heated water vapor from our mouth? What happens? The same thing. The vapor condenses. It turns solid. Okay? That's the essence of what is happening. It's nothing more than the freezing of water in a cold environment, originally in a vapor form. Now you will have to start asking what you expect to happen to that solid material in that environment over time. And I would start again by bringing it to ground level and asking yourself what would happen to you in Minnesota at 40 degrees below zero on a cold, very cold winter day when you breathe. You see it condense, and then what happens?
It disappears.
Of course, it does. It does two things over time. It will evaporate, dissipate, And mixing with the surrounding environment is certainly a major, if not the dominant, phenomenon that's going on. You're subjecting it to a broader medium, and it mixes with that environment. But also, if you have a source of energy such as sunlight, you also have a factor of evaporation that can take place there. So, yes, that's exactly what happens. Now, is there some reason to think that it is different up at 40,000 feet than what's happening in front of your face? Essentially, no. There's going to be some variables, but the fact is the phenomenon is essentially the same. And that observation was recorded exactly the same as we're speaking of since the advent of high-altitude aircraft. It is the common experience, observation. It's not just observation and experience. We can dig into the math and physics if we want, and that's what I've done, ultimately. But let's start with common sense. Let's start with experience, and let's start with observation. And that is the record of observation, that this is what happens. It will, under normal conditions, do exactly what it has done since the beginning of high-altitude aircraft, and that is dissipate, mix, and evaporate, combination of all of these three, in a relatively short period of time. In most cases, we're talking a matter of literally seconds to maybe a minute or so. That is also predictable through modeling. What that time span will be, and I've also done that. You know, you have observation, you have experience, and then you have the modeling world. And the modeling world is an attempt to pin down that experience in some kind of tangible form. But they both need to agree and make sense before it's all over with. This is how theories are developed. Theories are not absolute. They're a proposal, and then they have to be proven over time. And with new information, theories are often dismissed. There's nothing sacred about them. But they are an attempt to coincide reality with logic.
So this theory...
Pardon me?
The theory of the persistent jet contrail doesn't work. It doesn't hold up in the real world. That's what I'm trying to deconstruct or establish now.
Sure. We can start to examine that, okay? And the question is, okay... Start with the language again. First of all, why the introduction of the term? Why the appearance of the term? Why not in 1947, 1955, 1963, 1974, 1985? Why did you not have, as a common experience, language used in the sense of, Sonny, what you're seeing in the sky, there's a persistent contrail. It's not just a contrail, my son. It's a persistent contrail. Why was that language not used? The reason it was not used is because it didn't exist. There was no need or basis for that term because it did not exist.
You're saying the phenomenon did not exist then?
Certainly not at the level we're speaking of. Absolutely. Again, we can always try to come up with exceptions, and in fact, that's one of the common strategies of anyone that attempts to diffuse an argument is to isolate the exception and then generalize it to the whole and then try to dismiss the meaning or value of the general experience. And that's been done in numerous cases and continues to be done. We have to seek a common level here and allow for exceptions. And at some point, if we really have the time or need, we'll dig into those exceptions and see if they truly do explain the general rule. They do not at the case we're speaking of at all. And so the experience base was not there. There was no need for the term.
So this new term has been introduced to explain a phenomenon that is ongoing in our lives today, one that showcases white lines in the sky that are, you used the word mixing earlier, they appear to be mixing with something or spreading out. And they appear to be a very solid. They occlude the sky, and I'd like to get into some of the behaviors of this the element that we're talking about in this phenomenon. So I know we're going to come up on our break very soon, but this occlusion, diffusion, can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, yes, the essence is it's not water, and that's the problem, okay? That term, persistent jet contrail, is actually a contradiction in terms. It cannot really exist by definition if you trace back to what we spoke of earlier. So the fact that you introduce this term is because there is a need to try to explain something different. And ultimately what is different here is that what does make sense and what we are observing is not water. It is not water vapor being expelled under the conditions and environment that we described originally. So we are speaking of something different, and this is what we need to examine.
Right, and we will be going for a 3-minute break, and we'll be right back on the other side.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
You're listening to Expansion on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network. This is Sophia, your host, and I'm talking today with researcher Clifford Carnicom on the subject of aerosols. Clifford, you were saying that what's occurring in the skies is clearly not a contrail, and that they've masked this with a new kind of language, or they're attempting to do that.
Yes, if I can, Sophia, let me give another simple common experience example for us to try and relate to, hopefully, which is somewhere in between the two examples we gave of somebody breathing up in Minnesota, and we have a plane at 35,000 feet. And, yes, we're being led to the question of, okay, if it doesn't work, if it doesn't fit that which we know by experience as well as logically what should be happening, what is it? And that's where we will be where we're being led today. But if I can, a couple more intermediate points. Let's call up another example. We had a person breathing. We have an airplane at 35,000 feet. Let's do something in between. If you have a car, and let's make this a top-running car, top-notch car, clean as could be, beautifully running engine, and let's put that car running at 10,000 feet at the top of a ski area, and the guy gets a nice straight stretch, and he can go full speed. Now, you ask your and let's get the temperature down to 40 below again. And you ask yourself, if that car has a full run at 10,000 feet at 40 below, and he's running with his engine, what do you see coming out of that tailpipe? What happens? And it's the same darn thing. Do you see a trail lasting behind that car tailpipe around that ski area for, 10, 20 miles that this guy is driving? You don't. And it's the very same mechanisms and reasons we're talking about. If it's a clean running engine and it's water vapor, it's going to dissipate, it's going to mix, and it's going to evaporate. And if it's not doing that, then you can bet that engine's not clean.
So, and it's not water.
There's no difference here in terms of the basic phenomena we're talking about. Now let's start clarifying a little bit of the confusion that has been introduced with the language, and that is this business of a persistent contrail. When that term is introduced, you will usually find accompanying that language or that statement another statement, and it will be to the effect of, well, if the humidity conditions are high enough, it will almost always be qualified, and it will be qualified in a generic sense. You can look at the FAA, the EPA, whoever it is that is using this language, or those that wish to attempt to contradict the issue. They will accompany this statement, persistent contrail, usually with the phrase that if the humidity conditions are high or high enough. You'll also find in those same statements that the specific numbers, the details, which ultimately do become important, the details of that humidity level or number are never mentioned. It's always used in the word a sense of high. Nobody ever that I have seen that will use that language will pin it down. What I have done is do my best to pin that down. And the problem that you will run into is that the phenomenon that we are speaking of is not necessarily, in fact, not usually, accompanying the conditions of high humidity that are attached to this language. And, you know, I don't know how many papers I have on the site, probably a few hundred now, but six of these papers are directly related to these very early questions, you know, 10 years ago that came up, or what's the physics of what we're talking about here? And I dug into the humidity level, okay? And, you know, as an example, the very first paper, when this phenomenon started appearing, the very first thing I did, I said, okay, well, what's normal? What the heck do we expect to happen? What's the humidity up there? Let's just start with that. What's the humidity up there at the upper atmosphere? And if you look at the work, you'll actually find it's a fairly stable environment. The numbers are up there on the order of roughly 35% humidity would be a very common number, okay?
Right.
And then when the phenomenon started appearing, I say, well, gee whiz, somebody's saying maybe the humidity conditions are different and then everything is okay and this is all normal. Well, let's find out what the humidity conditions are when this phenomenon is taking place, where we have an obliteration of the sky on one day, and completely clear the previous day with no visible change in the upper environmental conditions, and yet somebody's saying, you know, everything's just fine. It must be the humidity changing. Well, I looked at the humidity. I have all the records are all there. I tallied the humidity levels, and it's upper atmosphere stuff I'm talking about. I'm not talking about ground measurements. I dug up the radio sonar, the balloon data, up at 40,000 feet, the whole thing. And what you'll find is that the humidity level was not different at all. There's no statistical difference at all. My numbers were 32% on the control base and 37% on the days of the egregious activity. There's no difference occurring. And so the hypothetical explanation given at a generic level, never specific, doesn't work. And it didn't work 10 years ago, and it doesn't work now, and it never has worked. And the introduction of the language is deliberate in its attempt to obfuscate the issue and confuse the understanding of the basic phenomena that are occurring.
Well, thank you. There's obviously some kind of cover-up going on. And we are going into our little break, and we'll be back on the other side with more.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
You're listening to republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is the show, Expansion, and I'm your host, Sophia, and I'm speaking today with researcher Clifford Carnicom. Our interview is to clear up certain mysteries or confusing aspects of the aerosol spraying operation. Clifford, you have established for us now in the first half hour of this show that there is definitely a cover-up of some kind going on, an obfuscation of the nature of what's occurring in the sky through the languaging itself, that the persistent jet contrail is an impossibility.
Again, I'll always make exceptions, Sophia. There's always exceptions.
Yes.
You know, and I would say except under unusual atmospheric conditions. There's always exceptions in life, but in general, yes, absolutely confirm what you're saying.
Yes, and we don't have this many unusual atmospheric conditions going on worldwide that would allow for something like a persistent contrail to form and stick around for hours and hours and hours. I use the analogy on my website. It's like persistent breath. If you were walking in Minnesota or Michigan on a very cold day, your breath would be following you around everywhere and staying, making a huge cloud around you, and you yourself would disappear in the solidity of that material. So something's happening up there, and it's I want to discuss a little bit the perception of what's going on. Human beings are losing the ability to perceive the natural world as it once was. Contrast is disappearing in the sky itself. I notice now it's harder to see the spraying because everything is white. The sun is white. The horizon has this mass of whiteness all along it. And I understand you've established in many interviews the nature of some of the elements that obviously have to be contained in this material. Metallic salts, particulate of various kinds, both metallic and biological elements, polymers. So I want to talk about the ionization of the air itself. When you gave your talk in L.A., that's what struck me very, very powerfully, that they have created now a charged environment in which we are all living. The air is no longer neutral.
You know, I'm glad you brought this up. There's another point I wanted to make, and it actually it may serve as a bridge between the topics we're talking about, but it's a follow-through on our discussion, and I'll leave that eventually, but there are a couple things that are still helpful to get in place, and they're going to tie in with what you just brought up on ionization. But, you know, we talked about the problems we have with humidity and the generic language and this type of thing. Well, two things I wanted to mention. The first was, and this is really sort of a surprise, this work was done about 5 years ago. It's very, let's say, low-key. I haven't really made a point of this article because it comes certainly can become a bit technical at points. But I want to bring it up because the finding from this project that I was involved in, this is back in May 2005, was really quite fascinating. And, you know, if you read this paper, I'm going to read the first line of this paper because it tells you how I was thinking about this paper at the time it was done. The first line of this paper is that it is thought that the graph shown on this page may well be at the core of the aerosol operations. And if you look at what's happening on this graph, for about 40 days, I collected a lot of data, and the data was primarily humidity level and ionization levels of the atmosphere. Now, collecting ionization data is not an easy thing to do. It took me years to be able to get to where I could, first of all, find an instrument that does this, to actually detect absolute levels, meaning the real number of ions. And ions, by the way, are charged particles. This is what they are. They're electrically charged particles. To actually come up with a means of measuring absolute numbers of ions is not an easy thing. I was finally able to accomplish that in 2005. And I collected ionization data along with humidity data. And really the most surprising thing, in a sense, happens here. But, you know, people have this discussion, and they use this language that, oh, well, this is all just fine. This all just happens because the humidity levels are high. This is why this stuff is persisting and everything's just fine. If you actually look at the results of this work, the most sort of amazing finding occurs, and that is the best that I can ascertain from my work, the most likely times that these operations actually occur, and I'm talking to a window down to a few hours. The work narrows it down to periods of a few hours at a time. The most likely time at which the operations are actually occur are at periods or moments of, number one, low humidity. The term I will use is local minimums. Local minimums of low humidity. Low relative humidity, and what else? Lower negative ion count. Now, I know that's a mouthful, but it means a lot, and it says a lot, because on the humidity level alone, it is in complete contradiction to the very claim that is being put forth by those that attempt to explain the phenomenon as entirely normal. And that is, if they say that they're going to couple it with high humidity conditions, the data shows exactly the opposite, what you would never expect. And that is that the operations are most prominent, most impactful, when the humidity is actually at the lowest point in a relative sense. In other words, it doesn't mean by necessarily number. It correlates with that. But what I'm saying is, let's say the humidity is 40%, and then it drops down to 30%, and then goes back up to 40. The 30% would be a local minimum. You know, it means relative to the surrounding intervening time period. And this, if you look at this graph under this paper, the title of this paper is what? It's called Ions and Humidity. If you look at the graph, it will show you this most amazing unexpected finding, and that is that the operations are occurring actually most likely in their greatest, let's say, grandeur and glory, excuse the term, but at moments and periods of relative low humidity as opposed to high. This is a major contradiction to the very arguments that are often put forth. The second element that you brought up here related to ions becomes eventually very important, and that's why I wanted to be able to measure this, because that's been an outstanding question in my mind for years. Years ago, probably 6, 7, 8 years ago, I did put forth the postulate, the thesis, that what does make sense? See, we have to get to the point, if it's not water, then what does explain what we're looking at, what's happening here? And I put forth the thesis that what does explain what we're seeing is that if you were to introduce a salt material, you start with a salt because you're looking for something that is operating under conditions of actually low humidity, not high, something that's affecting the water in the air, coalescing with it, combining with it, under conditions of low humidity. So how do you do that? Well, you start with the idea of a salt. The salt makes sense. There are certain salts that will absorb moisture at levels of 30% humidity. That was another part of the finding. You have to have a mechanism for what you're seeing. That's the first one that I offered. The second one is that not only a salt, but there are certain types of salts that become ionized. They become electrically charged with energy, and what's most phenomenal here is that the energy of the sun is sufficient to ionize the class of materials that I'm speaking of. And this is also a remarkable physical thing. In other words, when you electrically charge something, you have to put energy into it, and energy costs money, and it takes resources and this type of thing. You start dealing with a global system of the atmosphere. It's like, hey, you don't have a source of energy that you can afford to put up there to play around with this stuff at that level very easily. But what if you could capitalize on the energy of the sun itself? And so I did some examination, and the examination was at the specific energy levels. Is it actually possible that there are some metallic salts that can be energized with the amount of energy in the sunlight alone? And the answer is yes. I didn't know that to start with, but the answer is yes, that there are. And it's what's called a work function, but there are certain metallic salts that if you subject them to the energy in ultraviolet light, at the very end of the visible light, but primarily in the ultraviolet light range, there is sufficient energy to ionize those materials. And barium is an element that stood out here and continues to stand out as the most likely successful candidate with respect to ionization. It takes the least amount of energy, just about the least amount of energy that there is to ionize it. And, you know, just to bring up the contradicting folks, you know, I also have to and need to and want to be familiar with any of the counterarguments, because that's a part of the rational and fair scientific process, is to always seek other and alternative explanations for that which you think might be occurring. And I try to do that in a fair sense. And it's sort of interesting how some of this happens, but when I first put out this idea about ionization. And again, we had a basis for it. Actually, I was doing measuring where I was detecting salt forms in the rain, and that was unexpected to me. And so this is formed the basis of that. But when I put forth this idea that, you know, the sun is actually sufficient to put enough energy to to energize what we're talking about. You get the counter-argument. I remember the joke at that time, you know, and the joke there was, you know, Carnicum says, hey, if you put some table salt out on the porch, then it's going to become electrically energized. And, you know, the guy, of course, was making his attempt to diffuse the argument. But in principle, as you examine it, the answer to that was, well, yes, actually, that's actually quite true. Now, it's not table salt. It's not in a solid form on a porch. But the idea is exactly correct and remained correct. And furthermore, if you examine, like, the haze that forms off the ocean, if you look into that, you'll find that that's a result, can be at least tied in with the ionization of magnesium salts in ocean water. This is a very real phenomenon that I'm occurring. And by the way, ionization doesn't have to be visible. I'm just saying, indeed, there is ionization of salts that occur from the ocean. So this thesis was put forth. This thesis remains on my side and has only consolidated and strengthened itself over the years. I do contend, and now we can start getting into the claim that I would make, but number one, the materials that we're speaking of that are leaving a solid, visible effect upon our atmosphere, they are the result of a deliberate and systematic, broad-scale operation to disseminate massive amounts, distribute and disseminate massive amounts of extremely fine particulate matter into the atmosphere. That is a claim that I would make, and people will examine for themselves whether or not that claim holds up. But that is my claim. And it is an unfortunate reality and fact that aircraft have been and are being used to accomplish this process. You know, it's easy to make a joke of things. You know, you talked about perception, and it's just amazing the psychology of people and how we perceive things and how something can be framed in a humorous light, and then it is often dismissed just because of the successful proposal in a humorous light, it can't be serious. It just can't possibly be serious. You know, and when this issue first emerged and you just bring up the notion that an aircraft would be used to, you know, of course, the common use of the word would be spray. You mean an aircraft is going to spray you, okay? Very effective.
Right, and what is the purpose of ionizing the atmosphere in which we're living?
Well, when you have the ability to electrically charge an environment, the way I start is by saying everything changes. The whole thing changes when you start talking about electrifying an environment. And here's the simplest way I can start to introduce this subject. In the upper atmosphere, roughly maybe 6,100 miles, it varies in altitude, but in the upper atmosphere, quite a bit up, now I'm talking about aircraft stuff, I think about 60 miles, 50 miles, it starts. In the atmosphere, there is a layer, and it's called the ionosphere. And many of us have heard that term, and we know there's something up there. Let's explain a little bit what happens there. There is this layer up there called the ionosphere where you have exactly what we're talking about. You have a layer of electrically charged particles. Now, what was the impact of that? Well, we could start by saying that this is how radio was essentially discovered. The first communications by Marconi and such, what he did, you know, he was on... I think he was on the United States side, but this hypothesis was made or something. I think it was actually accidental. That's how it was discovered. It was accidental. But the guy sends a radio wave, and it ends up being picked up in, in Europe. And so in explaining what happened, they had to come up with a mechanism, and the mechanism is that you have a reflecting layer in the upper atmosphere called the ionosphere. So at the most elementary level, this was profound. It allowed for the whole development of radio. And so what happened there? You had an energized level, an energized medium that was allowing a signal to go from point A to point B over thousands of miles, where people had never seen anything like that before. Okay, so it allowed something to be done, and what it allowed to be done was to send energy from one point to another a very long distance in a way that had never been done before. So this was a major discovery for humankind with its respect to its advances in technology and energy usage. Now, in terms of perspective, it doesn't take much to cause a big change. The ionosphere, it's something like 3%. I found an article from London University.
We're about to break again for 3 minutes, and we'll be back. You're listening to Expansion on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org, with Sophia, your host, and my guest today is Clifford Carnicom, researcher of aerosol operations. Clifford, you were telling us that the ionosphere is a reflective layer in the atmosphere that sends signals, and it doesn't take much to condition, I suppose, the atmosphere to send these signals.
Yes, Sophia, what I was leading to there was that a small amount of change in the electrical characteristics of an atmospheric layer completely alters its characteristics and that which it can be used for. And the ionosphere is such an example. Apparently the number is on the order of 3%. Something like 3% of the mass of the ionosphere is actually ionized. But it completely changes the dynamics and electrical operating environment of that layer. And that was the simplest application, was that of reflecting the signal. Okay, but now if you carry it further, it doesn't have to be used just for reflecting a signal. It can be used to propagate or to extend or to carry a signal or to transmit a signal. And what we're speaking of here is the word is plasma. Plasma is not something that I knew about when I started in being involved in this work, other than, you know, Star Trek and this type of thing. But in the end, plasma is a term that we should all be very familiar with, and it's not that difficult, actually. Well, you know, when I went to school, they told me about three states of matter, solid, liquid, and gas, and this type of thing. That's what I learned. But for some of us that are a little younger and more on top of the scene, there is something called plasma. And when you look into it, most of the universe is plasma. The Earth is an anomaly. In a cosmic sense, to have something solid is actually an anomaly. A plasma is an electrically conductive gas. The cosmos, this universe, is primarily in a plasma state. They call it the fourth state of matter. It's literally the dominant component of this universe. Now, what it is a electrically charged gas. And the easiest way that I can describe this in our terms is that of a neon light tube would be the best example. Most of us are familiar with fluorescent light tubes, and ask yourself what's going on there. There is no wire in a neon light tube. It's a tube, and it's filled with gas, right? And what happens? You electrically charge it, and the darn thing lights up. It's really quite amazing in terms of what's happening there. This is what a plasma is. If a plasma, you have a conductive medium in it. You have ions. This is what you were talking about. You have ions in it. You have electrically charged particles within a gas, and if you subject it to sufficient energy, it does something. In this case, it lights, okay? You can also, you're also sending energy, because you know, you, when you plug that thing in, you have two prongs. So energy is going from one point to another. So you're transmitting energy also. So a neon light tube is a great example of the basis of what it is we're speaking of. Now, again, we have to extrapolate. But what if you could alter the entire atmosphere, not just have this layer up there that's occurring by in a natural state, but you could somehow alter the entire atmosphere of the Earth such that it had particles in it, and we're talking about very small, by the way, but these particles could become electrically charged or ionized with even the energy from sunlight alone. You wouldn't even have to build some big generator. You could actually use the energy of nature and electrically charge that environment. What would be the implications of that?